You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 2nd, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, and for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Wessel, author of Only the Rich Can Play, How Washington Works in the New Gilded Age. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court seems likely to uphold Mississippi's abortion law, banning abortion after 15 weeks, effectively overturning Roe v. Wade, and opening the floodgates for abortion restrictions across the country. More on that in just a second. Government funding is expected to run out at midnight unless Republicans and Democrats agree on a continuing resolution by then. And as of now, a group of Republicans led by Mike Lee is holding up the process because they want to vote on a vaccine mandate ban. And in Build Back Better news, Manchin is holding everything up there because he doesn't want paid family leave. And in the House, conservative Dems are doing the same on the SALT deduction, so tax cuts for the rich. The first Omicron COVID case has officially been detected in California. The traveler coming from South Africa, but let's be real, it's probably been here for a while. This comes as the Biden administration extends its mask requirement on transit through mid-March and expands its winter booster shot campaign. Stacey Abrams has announced that she will once again run for governor of Georgia in 2022 after she narrowly lost to now incumbent governor Brian Kemp, who was overseeing his own election. Just from a reminder about that, lots of shady stuff that went down there. And lastly, the Women's Professional Tennis Tour has announced that it will not host tournaments in China because of tennis star Peng Shuai, who has essentially disappeared after accusing a top government official of sexual assault. All this and more on today's program. Ooh, I got a frog in my throat. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out today. Obviously, it is Thursday, but we have a great show for you today. On this pretty dark day, I mean, not to start off here, but the moon is not in Lake Michigan, and yet the consequences of the Supreme Court remain incredibly dire. I don't know if they're going to rule today, but there is, I believe there's belief that it will happen. You have Marjorie Taylor Greene outside of the Supreme Court, kind of praying with the rest of the conservative activists who are stationed out there. I haven't really seen much footage of pro-choice activists clashing with them in any way, but there are certainly, there are gatherings outside of the Supreme Court right now because this is immensely consequential. Just to recap, the Supreme Court does seem poised to overturn over half a century, over 50 years of precedent, and let Mississippi's 15-week abortion limit stand, which significantly cuts into the viability standard that has previously existed. This is not official yet, I should say, as of the time of this broadcast, but based on the responses from the line of questioning yesterday, or based on the line of questioning, I should say, from the Supreme Court justices, I think everyone's fears are founded. Kavanaugh was openly warming to the states' rights arguments presented by the Mississippi Solicitor General, Scott Stewart, as well as this should be a legislative issue argument. That's really what a lot of the anti-Roe arguments kind of rest on. This is one of the quotes from Kavanaugh. Why should this court be the arbiter rather than Congress, the state legislature, state Supreme Courts, the people being able to resolve this? Well, I agree, Kavanaugh. You want to do away with judicial review? Awesome. You guys can just work on the judiciary side of things. You don't need to have any say over policy that is implemented.
Healthcare generally.
Maybe I'll take that trade off since the Supreme Court was so eager to weigh in on Obamacare. And it would also allow for an eventual passage of Medicare for All to be more cemented, hopefully, if we ever get to that place as a country, because the Supreme Court could not mess with it. That would be a big fear if we ever even get to a Medicare for All system. But I digress. The court was the arbiter in 1973 in Roe v. Wade. And thus, that question is resolved, Brett. You don't necessarily need to love it, but based on your own judicial philosophy or your purported one, you're supposed to uphold precedent. You are not a judicially activist judge, except, of course, they are. Of course they are. But, I mean, people like Kavanaugh, justices like Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, we already kind of knew where their stance was. And this is a 6-3 Supreme Court on the conservative side. But Roberts, John Roberts, at least on social issues, has tried to trend a bit more with liberals, progressives, sane people in this country. And so he's been a bit of a stopgap in that regard. But even he has been seemingly swayed by the anti-Roe arguments. He said that this was a quote from yesterday. Why would 15 weeks be an inappropriate line? Viability seems to me doesn't have to do any do with choice. But if it really is an issue about choice, why is 15 weeks not enough time? Because it's not enough time. And again, you are overturning past precedent in favor of this standard that's going to open up the floodgates. But they, of course, understand all of this. There is a reason that conservative judicial groups are well-funded and are quite active. And that's because they have enormous power over conservative justices like this. There were rumblings that these anti-choice groups were furious and growing in their anger with Amy Coney Barrett for not taking up the abortion issue sooner. So that's part of what this is. But you also have conservative media, Fox News notably, also threatening and trying to hold these justices accountable, these clerics, basically. Laura Ingraham on Fox News last night was issuing warnings to the entire conservative judicial sphere. Here's part of what she had to say in her long segment, seemingly, on abortion last night.
And if a court with a majority of 6 Republican appointees fails to put Roe to rest, then it should expect a conservative-led movement to shrink the court's power. Oh, and would also mean adios to the Federalist Society. And that's the angle.
Accidentally based. We're going to have a few of these segments. Marjorie Taylor Greene said on Steve Bannon's program that she and the people that support her are the base. We are the Republican Party. Both things true. Both things are true, and or at least in terms of what Laura Ingraham is saying. I would love to see the Federalist Society go away, and even more than that, I would love to see the Supreme Court be unable to participate in judicial review and have this amount of power. But that's the threatening part of this. Here she is talking to Ted Cruz, expanding on her outrage, even though it seems like she's going to get the decision that she wants, but conservative media has to flex their muscle in order to buttress things like the Federalist Society, honestly, even though she's attacking them here. But she's basically just trying to discipline them. Here she is talking to Ted Cruz about the same issue.
And it that decision, more than any decision in modern times, has produced enormous division in our country. Now, I am hopeful, and I think there's some reason to be optimistic, that the result of today's argument will be the court finally admitting that was a mistake, overruling Roe, which is the right thing to do. It's what I've urged the court to do, and returning that decision to the state legislatures.
Well,
and,
Senator, if we have 6 Republican appointees on this court, after all the money that's been raised, the Federalist Society, yeah, all these big fat cat yeah dinners, I'm sorry, I'm pissed about this. If yeah this court with 6 justices cannot do the right thing here, the constitutional thing, Then I think it's time to do what Robert Bork said we should do, which is to circumscribe the jurisdiction of this court. And they want to blow it up. Then that's the way to change things finally, because this can't stand. This is insane.
I would do that in a heartbeat. As you know, the Constitution gives Congress the authority to restrict the jurisdiction of the court. I think we should do that.
Absolutely.
You know, it is something sad looking at this court. And as you guys were going through counting noses, there are only two justices that I'm confident how they're going to vote on overruling Roe, and that's Justice Thomas and Justice Alito. Now, I'm hopeful we get to five. But I am not at all certain, and that's really unfortunate. And you know, you mentioned a minute ago the book I wrote last fall, One Vote Away. There's an
I don't understand how those are the two you're most confident in. Pretty confident in Amy Coney Barrett. Pretty confident in Brett Kavanaugh. And now, obviously, I'm pretty confident in Roberts. So they're going to get what they need, I believe. But like the idea that Ted Cruz is seriously, after all the time that Mitch McConnell and the rest of the Republican Party spent basically packing the courts with conservatives and preventing nominees from getting onto the Supreme Court, preventing Merrick Garland, pushing Amy Coney Barrett through with the help of a delirious Dianne Feinstein after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This has been arguably the most successful Republican project outside of deregulation, privatization, and the Trump tax cuts and the Bush tax cuts over the past 20, 30 years. They're not going to limit the court's power when they finally have everybody in line that they want. What Laura Ingraham and Ted Cruz are doing there is essentially issuing a warning, though, or false as it may be, trying to rile up the base in anger against the Supreme Court if they do not rule in the way that they're going to, I believe, and that they that Ted Cruz and Laura Ingraham want. But this is, I mean, regardless of the politics behind this and all the details I just outlined about how it seems like the Supreme Court justices are swaying and how the Federalist Society and how groups are responding to this and how conservative media is responding to this. I shouldn't let that be the dominant story. The dominant story is that a women's constitutional right to choose is on life support right now.
And this is going to be brutal for people. Just broadly, like, this is going to cause a whole bunch of suffering if they get what they want.
You know, you have Susan Collins saying that she's open to codifying the right to an abortion in law. Okay, you got one Republican. Do away with the filibuster. So that's all you need, honestly, because you probably lose Joe Manchin in that vote. And then hopefully you get Sinema on board and then you can pass it with 50-50. I mean, Democrats haven't gotten rid of the filibuster or haven't altered it for voting rights, which is their own asses on the line. They haven't done it for gun control, which universally the party says they're in favor of. And then you have Chris Murphy making tearful speeches on the Senate floor, but yet not really. I mean, I forget what his position is, but the party as a whole not moving on the filibuster. You have police reform. Party loves to fundraise off Black Lives Matter, but doesn't do anything to eliminate the filibuster in order for actual police reform to happen. If abortion rights doesn't do that, what will? This is going to be brutal, as Matt said. And then you're going to say, oh, the states have a right to choose what their laws are going to be. States are going to make different laws. And do you think that there won't be another Supreme Court case about crossing state lines and disallowing women from going to another state to get an abortion, even if they have the ability to do that? The people this is going to affect most are low-income women and families and non-white women and families who, you know, say you're in Texas. Are you going to have the ability to take off work and drive 12, 15 hours to get an abortion? It's already the case there. I mean, that's not going to happen. So, let alone, of course, implications for extreme cases like rape and incest. But we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by David Wessel, author of Only the Rich Can Play, How Washington Works in the New Gilded Age. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined right now by David Wessel, author of Only the Rich Can Play, How Washington Works in the New Gilded Age. David, thank you so much for being here today.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, of course. I'm really excited to talk about your book, because, you know, even just first reading the title of it, I got excited, because I love framing this current moment of extreme corruption and cronyism that we're in as the New Gilded Age, because there are so many parallels. And I also had no idea when I first saw the title, and then when I got into it, that we would be diving into opportunity zones, that concept, with, you know, that's the entirety of things. So can you just give the audience a sense of what opportunity zones are and why you chose to make that the focus? Here in New York City, the number one, I think, time that we heard about opportunity zones was when Amazon was trying to build their headquarters here. So why did you choose to focus on them, and why was that so central?
You know, it's funny you say that, because I had an argument with the publisher about the title of the book, and they forbid me from using the words opportunity zone and tax in the headlines, because I said that would turn people off. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is a book about opportunity zones. As you know, that when you deal with publishers, you get to say everything that's inside the book, and they get to weigh in on the cover and the title.
So, right.
opportunity zones are just a really interesting phenomenon for two reasons. One is, when do you get to write about the tax break that began with Sean Parker of Napster and Facebook fame? So that was what got me going on the story. On the substance, what this is an example of how somebody who I believe to be well-meaning, a tech billionaire who, like a lot of tech billionaires, thinks he has a better idea for everything than anybody in public policy or Washington or academia, has this notion that if only we gave rich people a tax break, they would put their money into poor neighborhoods. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 included a provision that created 8,764 tax havens across the country. Census tracts that provide that if you have a capital gain and you take that gain, you get a discount on your capital gains taxes and you get to defer payment on it. And paying taxes later is always better than paying them sooner. And then if you put that money into an opportunity zone, into almost anything, a business, a real estate, whatever, and you hold on to it for 10 years, you escape capital gains taxes altogether. And it's one of the few ways that you can escape capital gains taxes altogether without dying.
And to even get your foot in the door, you need capital gains. I mean, then that statistic that you said, only one in five Americans has access to capital gains or have them. So, I mean, that already is limiting in this kind of in a way that seems to contradict the name opportunity zone.
I think that's right. I mean, the title of the book is Only the Rich Can Play, because, as you point out, only the rich can play. We don't have very much data on this, unfortunately. The provisions that required reporting were stripped out of the bill as part of the reconciliation process in the Senate. But some Joint Tax Committee economists in Congress got a look at 2019 tax returns And they found that the average Opportunity Zone investor has income of $1.1 million, which is substantially above the average person. Now, the proponents will say, well, that's where the money is. So we went where the money is. But in fact, what I fear happened here is a provision that was sold as a way to improve the lives of people who live in poor neighborhoods is much more being used to reduce taxes for rich people than it is to improve the lives and economic fortunes of people who live in these communities. And one reason for that is there is nothing in the law that says that Opportunity Zone investments have to benefit the people who live in the community. It's if the property qualifies, if the business qualifies, it can get the tax break. So as I write in the book, there's a Ritz-Carlton hotel and condo complex going up in downtown Portland, Oregon, that's funded with Opportunity Zone money.
Well, we should say, when you mentioned the reconciliation process, this came as a part of the 2017 Trump tax cuts. So this is a fairly new phenomenon. And the fact that you were able to find so much about this, despite the deliberate black hole of information on these Opportunity Zones, I would imagine it was quite grueling research.
Yeah, well, I think I wouldn't call it grueling. It was actually a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It turns out that there are, in almost every community, and I spent a lot of time, as I mentioned, in Portland, Oregon, there are families that run the real estate, local real estate industry. It seems to be a family business, in part because the tax laws encourage you to pass it on to your children. And they love to talk about what they do. And they love to tell you about the scam that their competitor is doing. So it is hard to find out if people won't tell you whether a project in an Opportunity Zone is actually taking advantage of the tax break. There's no requirement that that be disclosed, which is outrageous. But if you ask them, most of the time they'll tell you. So it's just basic reporting. Now, some people have criticized me because, oh, it's all anecdotal. And my answer to that is, well, when you get more data, we can answer the questions with numbers. But since there are so few numbers, so little hard data, then the only alternative is what I did, which is go around and talk to people and do reporting. That Joint Tax Committee report that I mentioned found that 84% of the Opportunity Zones got no money whatsoever, and half the money went to the best off 1% of zones. And that's not surprising, because since there are so few guardrails, so few rules, naturally, profit-seeking investors, and most investors are, very few are social impact investors, are going to put their money in the places where they get the highest return with the lowest risk. And with 8,764 census tracts, there are plenty that meet that test, including the one in Queens where Amazon was going to build its headquarters until the community turned them out.
Which, you know, we were very in favor of the community turning them out. And that was an excellent effort aided by someone high profile like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at the time speaking out about it. And just we can back up to the origins of this lobbying effort by Sean Parker, which I'm very interested in as well. But one statistic that you cite, which I thought was we're based here in Brooklyn, was shocking, is 1/4 of all of New York State's Opportunity Zones are here in Brooklyn. I mean, this is kind of, it seems like not just federally mandated domestic tax haven, not mandated, federally allowed domestic tax havens, but also federally sanctioned gentrification opportunities.
Absolutely. So what happened was, it's kind of interesting. So after the Treasury looked at the law and they put out a list of census tracts that were eligible for designation, 56% of all the census tracts in America were eligible. And then the governors were told, you can choose up to 25% of the zones in your state to get this designation. The proponents were so against having big Washington involvement, and they had this kind of strange belief that somehow if you send it to the state capitals, it would be closer to the people and less corrupt or something, which anybody who ever covered a state capital knows that's not how it works. They didn't give the governors very much time to choose, nor did they give them much guidance, and they exercised almost no oversight over the process. So some governors made bizarre choices. Andrew Cuomo, I'm told, originally wasn't going to designate anything as an Opportunity Zone because he said, oh, it's a Trump tax cut. It's not kosher. He was talked into doing it, And then I can't explain why they picked 25% of the zones are in Brooklyn. In Austin, Texas, which is one of the fastest growing metro areas in the country, the city government, you know, reasonably asked for 4 census tracts to be designated. The governor of Texas gave them 21. That's just inexplicable. And in California, the initial list put out by Jerry Brown's office included the Stanford campus in Palo Alto. Fortunately, in California, they posted the list of proposed zones, and that one got knocked out before the ink was dry on the thing. So a lot of governors made strange decisions. Some made wise decisions, and some were in a very tricky position. I focus on Oregon because Oregon seems like a relatively clean state, and because, thanks to the local newspaper, we have Freedom of Information Act details on what was going on in the email exchanges among the governor's staff. And you can see them wrestling with, if we pick the really bad neighborhoods in Oregon, they won't get any money, particularly if our neighboring states don't do that. But if we pick the really good neighborhoods, what's the point? The places that are already drawing investment. So they kind of did 50-50. But what happened was all the money flowed to the ones that were already attractive to private investors, like the downtown, and very little to the rest of the state, as far as I can tell, where they really do need some investment.
You also cite Baltimore as an example of a community that is supposed to, in the, I guess, the surface level stated purpose of the bill, is supposed to be the kind of community that it benefits from these opportunity zones, and that is not what happened.
Exactly. So Baltimore is the perfect example of a struggling city, has lots of problems, has lots of violence, has lots of poor people, is surrounded by a county that has lower property tax rates, and it ought to be doing better. It's very close to Washington, which is a prosperous city. And it does have the big Johns Hopkins Medical Center, which you'd think would spur development and has to a limited extent. But what I found in Baltimore was, and that's just a question of going around and asking everybody, where's Opportunity Zone money going? And fortunately for me, a local foundation hired some guy to be the Opportunity Zone salesman for Baltimore. So I found scattered projects, not very many. There's a great project in a really bad block of bombed out buildings, where the entire Opportunity Zone investment is less than the cost of one of those condos in Portland. There is one big project in Baltimore that's drawing Opportunity Zone money. It's in an industrial vacant land that's being turned into a huge retail, office, hotel, residential complex. But that one already had $600 million worth of tax breaks from the city government, and it already had $250 million of Goldman Sachs' own money invested in it. So it was well on the way to being done, and subsequent investors are getting the capital gains tax break for investing in something that Goldman Sachs has already blessed and put its own money on the line for. So I think that Baltimore is a tragedy, because it could have been a real opportunity, if you will, for Opportunity Zones. There's a minister in Baltimore, Dante Hickman, at the Southern Baptist Church in East Baltimore, who does a lot of economic development in his community. He thought this was a good work for him. He actually, despite some criticism from his peers, went to Washington, stood next to President Trump, and said this was a great thing, spent a year and a half trying to get at least $1 of Opportunity Zone money for his community, got none, and is completely soured on the thing. So it's an example of the failed promise, I think, of the program.
Well, I mean, the program, we can get into this, definitely could have been targeted and improved. But part of this to me is, frankly, there's just an incompatibility with this kind of private investment and community improvement.
Well, I don't know if I would put it that way. We know that there are opportunity. Well, I can't use that word. There are ways in which private investment is really necessary, and if done right, can help lift the fortunes of a community. So I'll give you an example. There are some examples of people using the Opportunity Zone tax break for the purpose that it was sold as. There's a guy in South LA, his name is Martin Wodo. He's a Nigerian immigrant who went to Wharton, worked in private equity, and then got involved in real estate, and is now doing, his whole life is devoted to building affordable housing in South LA. He buys a lot of rundown apartment buildings, small apartment buildings, renovates them, and then rents them largely to people who are getting Section 8 federal subsidies. And his view is that Poor people are better tenants than most landlords think if you treat them well. And he had, this thing was already underway. It was a small but successful operation, and he supercharged it with Opportunity Zone money. And I think that's exactly what this was intended for. The problem is that if you're going to give people a tax break to put their money into a neighborhood, and you want to make sure that it's not just supercharging gentrification or building hotels or luxury condos or self-storage facilities, where there's a whole little industry of that, which, as you know, can employs next to nobody, then you have to either have oversight, like prior approval, which previous programs like this had, or you have to have some better guard rules and then in. So I don't think we want to say that private investment has no role to play in economic development. That's not the kind of economy we run. Although there are moments when I was working on this book where I thought, is it really possible to use the tax code to get people to do things that they don't really want to do and to avoid all the exploitation that comes from the professional tax avoider industry? Or maybe we should just raise their taxes and put the money into the things directly. And there are times when I think that might be the right answer.
Well, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, I maybe it was a bit of an existential thought. It's just more like, you know, it's necessary within the current system that we live in, but it's clearly insufficient. I mean, obviously, I think you have studied tax policy and are an expert in it. There is a simpler way, and that is just to raise taxes and also build affordable housing.
Right, right. And I think that part of the problem here is that they oversold this as a way to solve every problem. Interestingly, Sean Parker thought of this initially as a way to provide capital to small startup businesses, but it doesn't seem to be well suited for that. And the affordable housing thing is really interesting. A friend of mine, Brett Theodos of the Urban Institute, pointed out to me recently that in order to win in the Opportunity Zone space, you have to have a property that appreciates in value. But when we build affordable housing, we don't want it to appreciate in value. We don't want the first person who moves in to get, you know, a cheap rent, and then the neighborhood will get better and suddenly it'll become luxury housing and the guy sells it to some, you know, multinational real estate investment fund. So I think it's not well suited for the goals that the founders said it would.
So then you mentioned Sean Parker. I did want to return to that. Talk a little bit about his lobbying effort in this area. It seems to have gone back nearly 10 years at this point, obviously of Napster and Facebook fame, as you mentioned, played by Justin Timberlake in The Social Network. That's the number one thing that comes to mind for me. So how did his lobbying effort begin and how did it gain some traction?
Well, as I said, like a lot of successful Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, he thinks that because he did a few things well, he has a better idea for everything. And I think he is public spirited in the sense that he's spending a lot of money on cancer research and stuff like that. So he saw this problem that communities need money. His friends have money. How do we get his friends to put money into these areas? But unlike some of the other Silicon Valley guys, Mark Zuckerberg stands out. He was smart enough not to show up in Washington and say, here, I'm going to fix this. Here's the plan. He very cleverly created a little think tank, the Economic Innovation Group, and hired two young Washington insiders, a Democrat, Steve Glickman, a Republican, John Lettieri, both of whom had, among other things, worked in the Senate. And they spent a couple of years in stealth mode building the case that geographic inequality was a problem in America. As you know, we've long been talked about income inequality, the difference between the poor and the rich and the middle class and the rich. But if you look at what happens at the community level, increasingly, we had a period of time where regions of the country tended to converge in terms of median income, and now they're spreading apart. People are moving less often than they used to. So they helped build the case that we needed to deal with geographic inequality, and that leads to place-based policies. So after a couple of years of fertilizing this ground, they say, just what? We have a solution, and out pops Opportunity Zones. And it was very popular with members of Congress of both parties, I think for a couple of reasons. One is the simple talking point sounded pretty good, and the members of Congress weren't looking at the details. They were more into getting money into my district as opposed to giving a tax break for the rich people who knew. Secondly, Sean Parker is very charming, and he spent a lot of time talking to members of Congress and campaign contributions as well. And so the initial bill was pretty bipartisan. And their real coup was getting two prime sponsors in the Senate, Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, and Cory Booker, Republican, Democrat from New Jersey. They had like the perfect diversified portfolio. Like everybody else in Washington, they thought Hillary Clinton would win. Cory Booker would be their point person and defend them against the charge that this was just a way to cut taxes for rich people. Cory Booker, as mayor of Newark, was very much into providing tax incentives for business to invest in Newark. Well, Donald Trump won. Tim Scott turned out to be pivotal to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and managed to get this into the bill with very little notice. No hearings, not much scrutiny from outsiders. And that's one of the things that I find most troubling. I'm all for Scott, for Sean Parker coming up with good ideas. I just don't think that Sean Parker and the people he hires, the technicians, former congressional staffers and lawyers and lobbyists, should actually be writing the provisions that we end up in the tax code. And that's largely what happened here.
Well, this happens more than people realize, that right. Basically these interest groups and lobbying organizations, they write the tax code. It gets copy and pasted, particularly with Republican legislators. But Cory Booker being instrumental to this is really interesting to me because it tracks much with his tenure as mayor of Newark. This was very much in the vein of the kinds of stuff that he was interested in, implemented, and also got a little bit in trouble for with, you know, there were some corruption investigations into his close allies due to privatization.
Right. One thing that happened in Newark was that they did get some money from some legislation passed that provided tax incentives for businesses to invest in Newark. But almost all the land that was involved was city owned. So the city could decide whether to sell it for this purpose or not. Now, that may have been, I don't know anything about any corruption, but the city had some role in that. But in opportunity zones in general, there's no role for local government except local zoning. People come in, they build a building. The local government may not even know if it's getting the tax break. There are some exceptions. In the District of Columbia, if you're a district resident and you're investing in a district opportunity zone project, you only get the district level capital gains break on your taxes if the project has been blessed by the city authorities. But that's unusual.
Gotcha. This was through the reconciliation process in the Trump tax code. So it was the Cory Booker input was basically left out. And then Tim Scott just copy and paste.
Exactly. Exactly. So what happened is the Democrats get totally frozen out of the process of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. Tim Scott gets it in the bill and he gets a little assist from Donald Trump in an interesting way. The Trump White House was initially not particularly interested in this, although there were some fans of opportunity zones in the administration. They were much more focused on cutting corporate taxes. After Trump's unfortunate remarks at Charlottesville, there are fine people on both sides. Tim Scott, who's an African-American, went very public and said, this is outrageous what the president did. We need more moral leadership from the White House. The president invited him to the White House. Scott tells me, and he writes in his autobiography, that he expected a confrontation with Trump, but Trump mostly listened as Tim Scott explained why these words were so hurtful. And then at the end of the conversation says to Tim Scott, what can I do to make it up to the people I've offended? And Tim Scott is ready for that and says, you can endorse my opportunity zone legislation. The next day on Air Force One, reporters asked the president about his meeting with Senator Scott. And the president said it went very well, and I'm in favor of whatever this thing is he wants to do. And that's when the White House became a supporter. There's a guy named Jerome Smith, who was a low-level White House aide who had been on the Hill and was a fan of opportunity zones. And he tells me that after the president met with Tim Scott, his phone rang, and it was the chief lobbyist for the White House, Mark Short, saying, this opportunity zone thing that you keep talking about, which now part of our priority list, and what is it again? And so that gave it the Trump push. Later, actually, Trump totally took credit for it. For better or worse, it got branded as a Trump tax cut. Opponents of the thing immediately figured it must be a real estate scam because Trump was involved and accused the president and his son-in-law of doing it. I think that's not the case. I think that if you do something that's friendly to real estate, turns out a lot of Trump people, including Jared Kushner, take advantage of it. But then the president did something which rather cynical, which is every time someone asked him about what he was doing for African Americans, he would mention opportunity zones. Mm-hmm. And he hired a couple of black people to be promoters of opportunity zones in the White House. And so it became the kind of all-purpose answer to what he was doing for Tim Scott's community.
Well, he said it's an opportunity for you now to be right. In my White House. Opportunity.
Right.
I'm an opportunity zone in and of myself. You mentioned Kushner because, and Trump, obviously. I mean, this is like their dream too, right? I mean, one, it's a transactional way for him to, I guess, bury the Charlottesville controversy that he stirred up. That's the only way he kind of knew how to do things. And two, this is their language, right?
It's exactly.
Exploiting the tax code for real estate.
Right. So I think that if you can imagine this, I don't know this, but you can imagine when Tim Scott outlined this to the president got it right away. When it comes to tax breaks that real estate people can take advantage of, I don't think the president needed a briefing book to explain it. So I think that's absolutely right. And, it, you know, when I started the project, I went to an Opportunity Zone Expo at the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, which, as you've read the book, I just, my jaw dropped. It was like a 21st century gold rush because there is a whole industry of people, many of them in real estate, who exist to figure out what new goodie has Congress given us that we can use to save money for our clients.
So tell us, I mean, that's the first chapter or the introduction, I forget, of the book. It's yeah. The beginning. Tell us a little bit about the opulent Mandalay Bay Opportunity Zone Convention.
Well, I wouldn't say it was so much opulent, although you did have to pay $500 to be there. It was a sea of lawyers and tax accountants and wealth managers and investment company people, real estate people, some people looking for like a quick education on how they could save themselves money, some people who saw this as a way to get money. I mean, there was one guy there, the first I walked in, there's this guy there in a sea of people in, you know, sports jackets and sort of business casual. And he's got a cowboy hat on with a piece of white paper wrapped around it saying looking for Opportunity Zone money, getting attraction that way. As a reporter, it was a goldmine for two reasons. One is these are the most extroverted people who, even when you're standing there with your notebook, want to tell you their story. And secondly, in a crowd like that, people aren't careful about how it sounds. They didn't pretend that they were doing anything to help poor people. This was all about how can I save money on my taxes or how can I raise money from people who want to save money on their taxes. My favorite encounter was with a woman I met from L.A. who told me that a friend of hers was in real estate and asked her to run his Opportunity Zone Fund, but she decided not to do it. And I said, why not? She said, well, frankly, I already have a boatload of money. And my husband has an even bigger boatload of money. So I said, okay, so why come to this thing? And she said, well, I have this Andy Warhol painting that I bought shortly after he died, and it's worth a lot of money now. And I'm thinking about selling it and putting the proceeds into an opportunity zone. So you got to be kidding. So I said, let's stay in touch. I didn't at the time ask her what it was a painting of, but when I followed up, I said, you know, I never asked you, what is this a painting of? And then she told me, $3 signs. And I've seen the painting. It's a small painting about the size of your computer monitor with $3 signs. Now, in the end, she decided not to sell it. She didn't put the money into an opportunity zone. But it's an example of how bizarre this thing is, that people who have appreciated art trying to figure out how they can sell it and avoid paying capital gains taxes by investing it into some hotel or condo or office complex and getting federal largesse to do it.
Well, I mean, It's both shocking and also not shocking when you see how rich people often conduct themselves in trying to make every buck with, say, their accountants or their lawyers. I mean, this is just treated as another way to maximize the amount of assets that they have. And yet its stated purpose is anything but that.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. I mean, it's amazing. I shouldn't be surprised, but I am. The lengths to which people will go to avoid paying taxes, and then the people who are pretty rich to begin with. And then the second thing, and I hadn't appreciated this, is just how big the industry is of people who help them do that. There's a program called EB-5, which is a way to get If you're a foreigner and you invest in certain ways in the U.S., you can get a visa. And a lot of people in that business looked at this and said, oh, we know this business, and they just moved right over into it. And there's just a lot of money to be – there's a lot of – the middlemen make a lot of money in this thing.
Right. And that upholds the entire exactly. project as well. I just want to go over this again because we talked about it at the outset about capital gains and why this is so tantalizing for a lot of wealthy people. One, there's a bar to entry. Only one in five people have capital gains, but it's necessary to participate in the opportunity zone, but also just the tax incentives on deferring your taxes for 10 years or so.
Right. So first of all, so you sell something. Let's say you have a windfall. Let's say you sold a business or your a company which you own stock was bought for cash. So you have a capital gain. Or let's say you just bought Apple stock a long time ago and you want to cash in. So you sell that stock and you have to pay capital gains taxes, both to the federal government, 28%, or depending how you count it, and maybe to your state government as well. If you take advantage of this thing, two things happen immediately. One is you don't have to pay the taxes right away. You can put them off until 2026, and if they change the law, which some people want to do, maybe even later. And secondly, you get a discount on your capital gains taxes. So that's the first thing. That's kind of the incentive to get into this thing. But the big thing comes is you put money into some real estate project, which presumably you think will appreciate in value or you wouldn't do it. If you hold on to that for 10 years, when you cash in, you owe no capital gains taxes at all, none whatsoever. And that's really the big prize here. And for insiders in Washington, we know that 10 years is not an accidental number because Congress measures the cost of things in foregone revenues to the Treasury over 10 years. For this particular, this thing was designed so that all the money it loses comes outside the 10-year window. So it looks relatively cheap to the Treasury, but it probably isn't. Depends how many people put their money in.
I know that you don't have figures, but maybe we can estimate a little bit. How many billions of dollars are we talking in terms of like lost tax revenue?
Well, we know that it's in the single billion dollars worth in the 10-year window because there's this provision that you have to pay some money. I don't really know. We know that through 2019, there were $29 billion invested in Opportunity Zones, and I suspect there was at least as much money invested since then. So say there's $75 billion invested so far in Opportunity Zones. And let's say over 10 years that I don't know, say it doubles, your money doubles in 10 years. That's not inconceivable in real estate deals. So that would mean there's $75 billion of capital gains that will go untaxed by the federal government. That's roughly $25 billion. I have no idea if that's the right number. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot of money compared to the trillion-dollar bills we're talking about now. But when you look at how much money we actually spend on economic development in communities or affordable housing, it's a pretty big chunk. And really, one of the public policy questions is that the best way to get, is that the best, biggest bang for our buck? And I think the answer is no.
It's clearly no. It's the best bang for somebody else's buck or the best.
Right, exactly. Right. So in a way, I think my conclusion is that based on what I know, admitting that the data is pretty skimpy, I think this has done more to cut taxes for rich people than improve the fortunes of people who live in the opportunity zones who the program was supposed to help.
Right. And again, you don't have the data on this because it's by design, but this is just based on all of your research, which
right.
I trust and agree with you. I guess we can move to the present as we begin to wrap things up. Where is the Biden administration on opportunity zones? Like, I mean, we're talking about all these pay-fors and Build Back Better. Everything has to be paid for, all of this stuff. And yet the people like Manchin want to strip out all of these different tax elements for the wealthy. I mean, and then you have segments that want to take out the IRS enforcement, et cetera, which could be pay-fors. But this seems like an opportunity, no pun intended, for the tax revenue that these centrist Democrats desire.
So President Biden campaigned on it with a promise to reform opportunity zones. But so far, the Treasury has done nothing. on the regulatory thing, and there's nothing in the Build Back Better bill or any of the president's proposals that would do anything to opportunity zones, including making them more targeted at the desired purpose. There are proposals in Congress of all sorts. Some would make it more generous. Some would limit what you can put the money into. But so far as I can tell, none of them are going anywhere.
I mean, is there a senator or is there a lawmaker on the Democratic side that has this flag that's been talking about this in any way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Senator Ron Wyden, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, was very critical of opportunity zones. But I think it hasn't been at the top of anybody's priority list. It may someday get there. There is bipartisan agreement that we should have more rigorous reporting requirements. So I think if somebody put a bill on the floor that said we should have more reporting, and as long as they didn't make it too clever by half and say that, but the only people who can see the data are the IRS, I suspect that could pass Congress. But it's gotten lost in the noise of all the other things. I mean, I think it's a fascinating thing. And as I said, it's sort of a case study in how the tax code is manipulated. But it doesn't seem to be front and center. It doesn't seem to be the top of anybody's list right now in Congress, except Tim Scott, who wants to make it a little more generous.
That makes the opportunity zone numbers, the numbers
they,
of...
They want to... There are proposals, as I pointed, as I explained to you, under the current law, you have to pay some taxes in 2026. And some people want to delay that date till 2028, saying, oh, we lost a couple years worth of COVID, which would make it more lucrative. There are some proposals to revisit the designation of the zones, because everybody acknowledges that some governors did stupid things, but they don't seem to be going anywhere as far as I can tell. Of course, what we learned from this episode is that something can get slipped into a bill without much notice. The first national newspaper story that reported that opportunity zones were part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was a full month after the president signed the bill into law. I'm keeping an eye on it. You know, I went to the draft of the bill and Build Back Better, and thanks to, you can hit Control F and search something. I searched to make sure they had snuck something in, and I'll be looking later. But opportunity zones weren't in the House version of the Tax Cut and Jobs bill. Senator Scott got it in the Senate bill, and the conference included it, and nobody paid attention. And the proponents on purpose didn't call attention to it because they figured there's no upside to letting people know they had won until it was already signed into law.
Yeah. I mean, Ron Wyden's good on a lot of things. So, I mean, maybe just with now his chairmanship, maybe he could have some sway on this.
Yeah. There is a House subcommittee I testified before, led by Congressman Pascarelli from New Jersey, that's interested in this. But so far, I don't think they've done anything.
Well, hopefully they were listening at some point today, at least some people in D.C. Thank you so much. This was an excellent interview. David Wessel, author of Only the Rich Can Play, How Washington Works in the New Gilded Age. This is the Opportunity Zone book, even though it does not say Opportunity Zone in the title, just so people understand that. David, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour of the show. I could have done that interview for a long time. I was really interested in that, but I mean, that check out that book. I might be getting that as a Christmas gift for some people. I love me. I am an amazing passive aggressive gift giver. I give books when I believe there is a gap in my family member's knowledge on a certain topic, and then I give a book that is for that purpose. Anyway, enough about my
kind of revealed a little bit too much.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's kind of my bad.
People see the workings inside the machine.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is that no one's probably listening. But this is what happens when I host solo, right? I just treat it as like 5% of my therapy. Let's talk a little bit about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think the theme of clips from this first hour are conservatives accidentally giving accurate answers about what should be done or what or diagnosing things correctly. We played a clip before this of Laura Ingraham saying that the Federalist Society should go away and that we should limit the Supreme Court's power.
What use is the money that we spent on all these fancy dinners if they're not going to act how those donors
right.
wanted them to?
Which is, yeah, exactly. I mean, pull the mask off of that. And then also, if they don't rule the way you want, just limit their power.
Exactly.
I'm totally down.
And we'll redefine, like, rule the way we want as in terms of, like, extremely reactionary and in support of corporate power. And we'll call that constitutionality.
Ah, yep, exactly. And then, so now, though, we turn to Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was on Steve Bannon's show the other day. And she pointed out something that, honestly, we've talked about on this program a few times. This is a quick clip, but I think it's important to lay out kind of how she views her role in the Republican Party.
Here's the deal. In the GOP conference, they consider conservatives the fringe. This town up here thinks conservatives are the fringe. We are not the fringe. We are the base of the party, which is about 70% of Republican voters.
More,
75%.
Yes, she is right. There is a disconnect between her Republican colleagues and the rest of her kind of extreme QAnon squad, basically. This is how the Republican Party wants the representatives to conduct themselves. There is a reason that after Marjorie Taylor Greene had these numerous controversies and was stripped of her committee assignments, that you have Paul Gosar tweeting out garbage like the Attack on Titan parody where he's killing AOC and assaulting Biden. He gets to be stripped of his committee assignments. Maybe he doesn't want that, but if he does get stripped, okay, the next strategy is that he'll just get a bunch of small dollar donations and he'll get a lot of publicity from this. And then Lauren Boebert saw that opportunity as well. Wow, I can just completely spew anti-Muslim bile at Ilhan Omar and incite violence against her and be a stochastic terrorist, basically, or promote, how do you say it?
Stochastic.
Stochastic. Jeez, I've had trouble with that before on the show. Stochastic terrorism against Ilhan Omar. Like, there are incentives for Republicans to act in this manner as lawmakers, and why is that? It's not because they are the fringe. It's because there's a large pool of people who this rhetoric appeals to. That's something that someone like Steve Bannon understands. It's something that someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene understands. And it's something that the Democratic Party, for some reason, cannot understand. They cannot comprehend that the people that they walk the halls with and the people that they write legislation with are nut jobs. Or at least that the people that vote for them want more of Marjorie Taylor Greene than they want of Adam Kinzinger, which is why Kinzinger is not seeking re-election for that very same reason, because they are. That's why Liz Cheney was sanctioned by her state Republican Party, because she dared to say that Donald Trump did not win the election.
Like, there are multiple videos of Boebert say that Jihad Squad thing. The specific, like, elevator story with the backpack.
Yeah.
That's a stump speech for them. That means it's practice. It means she said it all over Colorado, right? Like, this is the language that they're communicating to their supporters on.
And it builds on itself as well, because the more this is normalized, the more the base is going to crave it. It, like, why would you want the distilled, or why would you want the watered down version of the real shit that you really want, right? I mean, they want, that's what they want. They want their representatives calling members of Congress that are female, that are non-white, racist names and using those tropes. I mean, that's what they say behind closed doors anyway. And so leadership does have consequences. And when you normalize this in the halls of Congress, those kinds of voters are gonna want more of it. And it, unfortunately, it doesn't have the narrowing effect or the chiseling off effect that lawmakers think that it does, essentially. Because they all have money, they all participate in cocktail parties together, they all kind of have a shared understanding that is separate from the rest of the country. And so it's a myth that the more they stray from the cocktail conversation, the more that representatives do that, the less that voters are going to vote for them. No, I mean, by nature, Republican voters trend authoritarian, and the great majority of them are going to support them and continue to go down that road, maybe even support them with more ferocity, and then also adopt a lot of those same attitudes just by the nature of that voter. So not understanding the enemy and not calling them the enemy has consequences. And I know this turns, of course, into a Democratic critique, but it's within a Republican critique.
Well, no, I mean, I think there are, like, there are Democrats and Republicans that are able to identify, like, M. Marjorie Taylor Greene as a crazy, right? But they also think we got crazies coming in the left, too, and they're anti-Semitic, right? Because they have critiques of Israel. And this is, you see this a lot in Europe when they talk about, this is the threat of populism, and Macron is going to fight populism. And what you really see is, like, oh, they're taking shots at, veiled shots at Jeremy Corbyn this entire time.
Well, talk about the anti-Semitism playbook.
Exactly.
Right. All right, folks. That is it for the first hour of the show. Thank you so much for being with us on this A Majority Report Thursday. We will head into the fun half now. But yeah. I was going to do the, you know, spiel about the phone number. Oh, I haven't opened IMs yet, like an idiot.
You can spiel away whenever you're ready.
Oh, 646-257-3920. We will be taking your calls. But first, Left Reckoning. Matt, how was it?
Yeah, Paul Prescott on to talk about his run for state senate in Pennsylvania. Very interesting perspective on, you know, why you might run. Hey, Bender, how's it going? Why you might run for a state senate seat over a municipal seat, particularly because that's where the money is. It turns out that's where if we can get somebody on a state senate, that's where Paul thinks we can do the most good. And check that out. Interesting discussion. Paul is as good as anybody when it comes to the labor left alliance, and I'm excited to see his run. He also needs a support. So if you have any money to throw at a good candidate, go support Paul Prescott. We have the Act Blue in the Left Reckoning comment or description. So check that out. And we also talked about David Griscom did a sort of classic Griscom Economic Minute segment on inflation and what the response is to that. So a good Left Reckoning last night. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to support the show.
Amazing. Amazing. Hey, Matt and Brandon. Matt, what's happening over on Doomed?
Hello, everybody. How are you? On Doom tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/Matt Binder and twitch.tv/Matt Binder. I'll be having on Andrew Perez of the Daily Poster to discuss basically how corporate lobbyists are making sure that we are stuck with this right-wing Supreme Court forever. That tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time. So check it out. It'll also be up as a podcast version, like an audio only version afterwards at doomthecast.com.
Awesome. Brandon.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon, Matt. Good afternoon, Emma. How's everyone
doing? Good afternoon, good sir. What's happening over on the discourse?
Unfortunately, we were unable to record during the holiday season, but, you know, stay tuned to my, Patreon feed. We'll definitely stay tuned there, but stay tuned to my, Twitter feed for updates about the next episode. We'll get that out for you probably sometime early next week.
At Pretty Bad Lefty.
At Pretty Bad Lefty. You know, I've been shadow banned by the powers that be due to my, you know, unfiltered, I hate to say truth saying, but, you know, that's what it is. My
truth saying. You and Dana Loesch.
Yeah. Huh?
You and Dana Loesch.
I mean, honestly, like the shadow realm, as I like to call it, is full of, you know, truth tellers, visionaries, and of course, dream weavers. So, you know, you got to go look for me instead of expecting me to show up in your own feed.
Yeah, it might be helpful if you had your real name in the title, but it's not that.
Well, I mean, that seems a little low effort. I've been trying to work in some more puns, but I'm not very funny. So it becomes, you know, a labor of a Herculean effort to just come up with some words that mean two different things.
Yeah, maybe
not very funny. What? You can be humble. But that's a lie, Brandon.
Is that a short joke? Because I'm sure.
All right, folks, we are going to head into the fun half now. 646-257-3920. We'll be taking your calls. We'll be reading your IMs. We'll be having a grand old time. See you then.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the breaks to do that.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.